This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think not only are we looking at a situation where the security situation in both countries is likely to continue to deteriorate and possibly deteriorate at a much more rapid pace, we can expect that these juntas will continue to make the claim that, because of that deterioration, they need to remain in power.
That was Dan Izenga, a research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, on how the rising violence in Mali and Burkina Faso could continue to worsen. Details coming up. Also, Botswana faces an exodus of health workers to the United Kingdom. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The British government today said it plans to organize more flights to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda after a court judgment grounded the first plane due to takeoff. Home Secretary Priti Patel said preparation for the next flight begins now despite court's ruling that none of the migrants earmarked for deportation could be sent to the East African country. The UK government plans to send some migrants who arrive in the UK illegally as stowaways or in small boats on a one-way trip to Rwanda. The plan has faced heavy criticism. The European Court of Human Rights ruled late yesterday that those aboard the first flight due to depart faced a real risk of irreversible harm. Home Secretary Priti Patel spoke in front of Parliament today.
Now, Madam Deputy Speaker, I welcome the decisions of our domestic courts, the High Court, the Court of Appeal, and Supreme Court to uphold our right to send the flight. However, following a decision by an out-of-hours judge in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, minutes before our flight's departure, the final individuals remaining on the flight had their removal directions paused while their claims were considered. I want to make something absolutely clear today, Madam Deputy Speaker. The European Court of Human Rights did not rule that the policy or relocations were unlawful, but they prohibited the removal of three of those on last night's flight. Those prohibitions last for different time periods, but are not an absolute bar on their transfer to Rwanda.
Patel said the government was disappointed in the ruling, but the government thinks it is fully compliant with domestic and international obligations on asylum seekers.
This government will not be deterred from doing the right thing. We will not be put off by the inevitable legal last-minute challenges, nor we will allow mobs, Madam Deputy Speaker, to block removals. We will not stand idly by and let organised crime gangs, who are despicable in their nature and their conduct, evil people, treat human beings as cargo. We will not accept that we have no right to control our borders, Madam Deputy Speaker. We will do everything necessary to keep this country safe, and we will continue our long and proud tradition of helping those in genuine need.
Deportees will have their asylum claims proceeded in Rwanda and, if accepted, could stay in Rwanda rather than return to Britain. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government says the plan is a legitimate way to protect lives and thwart the criminal gangs that send migrants on risky journeys from France across the English Channel. Human rights groups argue that the plan rides roughshod over the protections afforded to refugees under rules set up after World War II. They have called the idea unworkable, inhumane, and a waste of money. Britain paid Rwanda £120 million, $150 million up front for the deal. Michelle Rong is a writer and journalist with more than 20 years' experience of covering Africa. She is the author of Do Not Disturb, the story of a political murder and an African regime gone bad. Douglas Mpuga reached her in London, and she was critical of both Britain and Rwanda about the agreement.
Well, it seems a really cynical deal. It's astonishing to me that people are thinking of deporting refugees to one of Africa's most densely populated countries. It's also a country which has a large existing refugee problem of its own. It has 130,000 refugees already living in Rwanda who are living in tented camps. And there's not much room to go around, not much available land, and not exactly a great number of jobs for these people. But above all else, there's a whole issue of Rwanda's human rights record, which it really doesn't stand up to scrutiny. This is a country where we know that British officials have criticized Rwanda in the past for the fact that it goes in for extrajudicial killings. We know that journalists and members of opposition parties and human rights activists disappear. They're killed, they are arrested, they end up in jail.
You've been in Africa and you know Rwanda very well. Why do you think what you mentioned didn't come into question?
I think here in Britain, there was a real desire by the Home Secretary, Priti Patel. She was very determined to show that she's tough on immigration. That was really her sales pitch. A lot of people had been criticizing her for not cutting down on the numbers of immigrants that Britain is taking. Her policy is very popular with the right wing of her party. And I think for Rwanda, this was a case of Paul Kagame wanting to show to a Western ally and one that provides him already with quite a bit of foreign aid that he can be very useful, very indispensable. So what you've been seeing is that ever since this policy was unveiled, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, and Boris Johnson, they have nothing but nice things and warm things to say about Rwanda, about the Rwandan political regime, about Rwandan society. And all the criticisms we've heard in the past about Rwanda's human rights regime and its record in the Great Lakes, all of that has suddenly been put aside.
Talking of what will happen, it's not the first time Rwanda is purportedly hosting refugees from other countries. They got some refugees from Libya, from Israel, and some sources say none of them is still in Rwanda at this time.
I think the refugees from Libya are still in Rwanda, but they were quite a small group. They were apparently only 1,000 of them. The ones who were brought over from Israel under a similar deal, however, between 2014 and 2017, they did not hang around. And the reason for that is they didn't want to be in Rwanda. These were mostly Eritreans and Ethiopians. Then they found themselves being shipped out to Uganda and Rwanda. And I think all they did was to sort of start the long journey back to the West. And I think we may see that happening with this group of refugees when the numbers begin to build up.
That was Michelle Arong, a writer and journalist who has covered Africa for more than 20 years. She spoke with Douglas Mpuga by phone from London. Botswana faces an exodus of health workers to the United Kingdom, with more than 700 expected to migrate. Authorities in the UK have confirmed the first group of 66 will report for duty in August. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
The Botswana Nurses Union earlier this year reached an agreement with a leading UK-based recruiting agency, NEU Professionals. The local union spokesperson, Aobakweli Solami, says up to 700 Botswana nurses have signed up to work in the UK. He says the health workers are lured by prospects of better pay and working conditions.
It will be a couple of reasons. Firstly, is that there have been the desire to leave Botswana. You know, Botswana is a developing country, and I think a lot of professions, not only nurses, they desire to work in the first world where they are, you know, advanced systems, better remunerations, and a lot of other benefits.
He says the government has not adequately taken care of health workers, and that treating the nurses better will reverse the brain drain.
I think they will not live in droves if the working conditions were better, if progression was better, and if also they were recognized and appreciated for the hard and good work they are doing.
The BBC reports at least 66 healthcare workers from Botswana who are trained in mental and physical health will join the National Health Service in August. Botswana is far from the only African country to lose nurses and other health workers. Local media reports say more than 2,000 nurses left Zimbabwe in 2021, which could further cripple the country's struggling healthcare sector. Botswana's Minister of Health Senior Public Relations Officer Christopher Nyanga says it is regrettable to lose health workers to other countries.
The departure of nurses in huge numbers could definitely affect health service delivery in Botswana. Health is one of the most sought-after services in the country. Therefore, it is important that all resources necessary for the full function of the health system are in place. The ministry regards healthcare workers, including nurses, as a critical resource for the full functioning of the healthcare system.
He says the government is in the process of improving the conditions of service for nurses.
It is for this reason that the ministry has initiated some changes that could see healthcare providers, including nurses, seeing an improvement in their conditions of service. The ministry has also started a massive training initiative that will see many nurses getting enrolled for higher training in various fields in the nursing profession.
The UK is facing a healthcare worker shortage with demand up due to challenges presented by the COVID-19 pandemic. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Nigerian authorities are searching for 17 people abducted yesterday in the capital Abuja by armed men disguised as police. Nigeria has seen a wave of mass abductions for ransom in the country's north, but the insecurity rarely reaches the capital. The Abuja Police Command yesterday made the announcement on Twitter in response to a viral tweet by one of the abductees, Amira Sufan. Sufan made a post on Twitter yesterday afternoon calling for help after she said she and 16 others, including three pregnant women, had been abducted from their homes in Abuja by six men disguised as police officers. Their captors apparently were not aware she was using her phone. Somalia's president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, has named Hamza Abdi Bare the new prime minister. Hamza is a member of the lower house of parliament. He was elected to the house for the first time last December. Previously, he was the chair of the Jubaland Regional Electoral Commission. He is a member of the president's Political Peace and Development Party and served as its secretary general from 2011 to 2017. He is also a former senior advisor to the Ministry of Constitution Affairs and Federal Government from 2015 until 2019. Hamza's appointment came exactly a month after Mohamud was elected as president. The third and final round of Libya's constitutional talks between the House of Representatives and the High Council of State are underway in Cairo through Sunday. In her opening remarks, UN advisor on Libya, Stephanie Williams, urged HOR and HCS members to devise a constitutional framework for elections and told the spoilers and armed groups to stop intimidating people, adding that the international community will not stand by as violations continue. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi whether the two sides would put their disputes aside and agree on the election's legal basis.
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see too much progress from these talks. Although we've seen the House of Representatives and the High State Council meeting together and discussing different elements about the constitutional framework, they have made some progress on agreeing part of the constitution, but actually the issues that remain have been contentious for many years. They're very unlikely to be able to reach an agreement on. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, which is what Stephanie Williams is referring to, I think, an increased kind of polarization between the actors supporting Bashagha in the east and Dabaiba in the west, and that's spilling over into these political talks as well, which I think makes it unlikely. In addition, although the UN is making these statements and is supporting the talks, we've seen that the international community is really quite divided on Libya and isn't in a position to really be making, backing up their claims that they won't stand by as violations continue. So unfortunately, I think we're not going to see this leading to elections in Libya anytime soon.
The talks in Cairo come on the heels of clashes between rival militias that revived nightmares of previous bouts of fighting in Libya. The U.S. ambassador to Libya, Richard Norland, threatened to sanction those responsible for the fighting, saying they will pay a price with the Libyan people and the international community. Would that deter the rival militias who are backing the rival prime ministers, one in Tripoli and the other in Sirte?
A lot of the militia activity that we're seeing in Tripoli at the moment and renewed clashes is because of this political polarization, as different armed groups backing either one side or the other. But it's also that these groups in particular are trying not only to pick a horse in the kind of national contest for power in Libya, but they're also trying to secure their own local power bases within the capital and controlling territory and ensuring that they are stronger than their rivals. And so as a result, because the political situation is so uncertain, I think we will continue to see this kind of low-level clashes and a bit of an increase in some of this violent activity in the capital. At the moment, I think it's unlikely that this will escalate into broader conflict, but it's certainly a big concern for international actors and, of course, for the Libyans who are in the capital. But as I mentioned before, unfortunately, despite the US and the UN making comments on this matter and condemning the issues, the international community has really shown that it's got very little power to influence what is happening in Tripoli at the moment. So I think we will see this kind of low-level kind of militia activity continue in the coming weeks.
Libya's oil minister, Mohammed Aoun, has said that almost all of the country's oil fields were shut down, putting further strain on the already unsupplied oil market. Could the U.S. and Western countries pressure Libyan rivals to stop using oil shutdown as a political leverage?
Yeah, so the oil shutdowns are becoming a big issue. And as you mentioned, a lot of oil is off at the moment. There is some debate or some uncertainty around whether all of the oil is off, as Aoun has claimed, or if some of it may be online. But we haven't seen any comments really on this from the National Oil Corporation, so it remains a little unclear. But certainly the US has been very concerned about the ongoing oil blockade. Some oil has been off in Libya for the past 2 months due to shutdowns. And they have been trying to push the introduction of a financial mechanism, the idea being that this would depoliticize Libya's oil revenues and stop them being used by one side or the other to further their own gains. While the US and some other Western countries are pushing for this mechanism to be introduced and there is some progress, again, it still remains unlikely that this will actually be implemented in the immediate term, which means that oil blockades are probably likely to continue. We haven't seen any statements from international countries about the latest oil blockades in the last few days, and it does seem like they are trying to avoid making the situation worse or taking a political position themselves. So it will be interesting to see what happens and whether they are able to introduce this mechanism, which could help to solve this issue with the oil.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The World Health Organization is creating a new vaccine-sharing mechanism to stop the spiraling outbreak of monkeypox in more than 30 countries beyond Africa. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the agency is developing an initiative for fair access to vaccines and treatments that it hopes will be ready within weeks. The mechanism was proposed shortly after Britain, Canada, France, Germany, the U.S., and other countries reported hundreds of monkeypox cases last month. WHO has described the outbreak as unusual and said the virus's continuing spread was worrying enough to convene its expert committees next week to decide if monkeypox should be declared a global emergency. Vaccines for smallpox, a related disease, are thought to be about 85% effective against monkeypox. Europe remains the epicenter of this escalating outbreak, with 25 countries reporting more than 1,500 cases, or 85% of the global total. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. A new wave of violence has uprooted thousands of villagers in northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province, especially in the Anquebi district, a previously safe area that had been hosting large numbers of families displaced from other districts due to fighting. Bretish van Leith, Save the Children country director in Mozambique, describes to VOA Carol Van Dam the brutal violence that has occurred between June 2nd and 9th and its impact on children.
Scenes that they have been describing in the past days are actually the scenes that people have been describing since the start of this conflict. And those are very, very violent incidents such as rape, killing, beheadings in some cases, and other forms of extreme violence.
When you say beheadings, what are they doing? What kind of weapons are they using?
They are using machetes.
Do you know who is attacking who in this conflict?
The conflict is in the north of the country by a series of non-state armed groups going around to attack villages and villagers. Who are the exact perpetrators? We don't know.
For outsiders, though, can you try to describe why these men, we're assuming they're men, going into these villages and just attacking what would seem to be innocent, unarmed people?
There is no critical answer to that question as yet. What we can say is there is a complex underlying situation in the north of the country that may trigger the conflict, but there is no such claims as to what the attackers want or specifically why they're attacking villages or villagers. What we are worried about, obviously, is the way in which it happens, but also the extreme effects on families and on children.
What can you tell us about the kind of people who were displaced by this latest violence? Is it called Anquebi?
Right. The latest attacks were both in Anquebi district, as well as Chiure and Michufe. Those are districts in the southern part of Cabo Delgado province. And these are the first of its kind in those southern districts. Up until now, most attacks we've seen were in the north of the province. It's coming closer south as we recently, yes.
You mentioned that Anquebi was previously considered a safe place. Does Save the Children know what happened?
What we do know is that the situation at the moment is becoming more unpredictable. The attacks are becoming smaller in nature and more dispersed and seem to be coming more south.
And what are the conditions like for the displaced, and how have humanitarian operations like yours responded?
Conditions are not good for the displaced. First of all, really psychologically, it's been extremely hard for people to deal with these atrocities and to have been uprooted not only one time, but two and sometimes three times, which is obviously very hard in our case for children to be just starting to rebuild their lives and trying to have a more stable outlook and then being uprooted again and having to witness all these terrible incidents. So I would say that is as the first very important thing that people are dealing with and that we as an organization that Save the Children are trying to support children and their families with, to provide them psychosocial assistance and the protection that they need. But obviously the needs are wider than that. People lack food, people need proper toilets and access to water, they need nutrition, they need health care, they need education.
That was Bretish van Leith, Save the Children country director in Mozambique, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from the capital Maputo. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.